Reverend Al Sharpton, one of a kind, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation, the founder and president of the National Action Network, one of the leading civil rights organizations in the world. Reverend Al has over 40 years of experience in community leadership, political operative, minister, advocate. He's got a new book, and we're going to get into that book. It's called Righteous Troublemakers, The Untold Story of Social Justice Movement in America, and the men and women, many names you don't know, stories you're unfamiliar with, and how they have helped shape the American civil rights experience. Got Reverend Al coming right at you. Reverend Al Sharpton, welcome to the podcast, my friend. I tell you, it is great to have you back in the neighborhood because you and I, we always know how to mix it up just right.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be with you again, Michael Steele. Sorry you're not running, but that's another show.
Yeah, that's another show. It was a painful decision, but I think it was an important one given everything that's going on and the fact that my wife said, not right now, baby. So you know how that goes. Well, look, I'm excited about this conversation because you have now brought to the foreground something that I, for probably 15 or 20 years, have given speeches on, the idea of the unsung heroes, the men and women out there who actually change more of the game than we may realize in so many respects. You have a new book that's out now, HarperCollins, Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. And what I love about this book is that you not just pull back the curtain on your relationships with the various families who have been traumatized, you know, Trayvon Martin, et cetera, over the years by racial injustice, police brutality, et cetera. But you give it context. And what I want to draw on right out of the gate was how you set it up. You say, quote, "I found myself thinking of history's unknown and unsung heroes, the nameless and the forgotten, the courageous change makers we've either overlooked or cast aside, preferring to shine a light on the actors who take the main stage. I thought of all the other people who had participated in the march, and I was humbled, amazed, and grateful to be in their presence." The march you're referring to was the last march on Washington on August 28th last year, where you, of course, in the midst of everything that was going on politically, in 2020, politically with the election and everything. It struck you in that moment as you're in that crowd and seeing those people that all of this works because of them. And they don't get the headlines, but they're the change agents.
No doubt about it. And you were right, it's 21.
Because, 21, that's right.
Yeah, because what happened was I was on my way to the platform. We had called We had called the march. I had called it during the funeral for George Floyd. And we put it together in the middle of the pandemic. And Martin III, who always works with National Action Network and I in doing things, was saying, well, how are we going to pull it? How are we going to fund it? We put our heads together. And then we got out there, we put it together. And we got there that day, had flown in the Floyd family, Breonna Taylor's mother, the family of Ahmaud Arbery, everybody there. And I'm headed to the stage, and there's 200,000 people there. We had taken everybody's temperature, made everybody wear a mask. Right. But we never thought we'd get that kind of crowd. And as I was walking to the stage, to the steps that Dr. King had spoken on in 63, I just out of the corner of my eye saw this man jumping up and down with something in his hand. It looked like an old man in his 80s, maybe.
Right.
And I said to the security, I said, what is that man trying to say? And they said, keep moving, Reverend. I said, no, get that man. And they brought him over. And he looked at me, he said, this is a button. And I looked at the button and said, March on Washington, freedom now. He says, I was here with Dr. King in 63, wow. And I wanted to be here with you today. And he hugged me and went back in the crowd. And I tell you, Michael, that haunted me a few days, because I said, here's a man that knows he's not going to be on the news tonight.
Right.
Knows he's not going to be in the Washington Post tomorrow. But he comes, and he came 58 years ago. And what is it that makes these people come and know they're never getting credit? We get a little limelight. I mean, we get abused, right, but we get limelight. He gets nothing other than the righteousness of the cause. And I said, we need to talk about the righteous troublemakers. While I have this exposure, I should give some limelight to those. Because supposedly we call a march and nobody came.
Right.
And these are the people that made the movement work.
They do. They are the unsung heroes in so many ways. And you go back and you look throughout history at the men and women, you know, everyone may know Dr. King, but they don't know necessarily Ralph Abernathy.
Right.
And it is that kind of parallel existence that makes the movement what it is, but also it says a lot about the leadership and the leaders who are able to pull something out of people that 58 years later, okay, so we will start with the fact that 58 years later, we still have to have the damn conversation about our rights, okay?
Right.
We'll get into that in a moment. But 58 years later, someone who was there in front of King, now wanting to be in front of you, you representing that arc in time, of not just struggle, but a response to that struggle. How do you put that in the book? How do you see weaving that narrative of your leadership and those around you, whether it's at the National Action Network, which I've had the privilege to speak before in the past, or the work you do when you're doing your big rallies, or the moments you're spending with these families? How do you find the ability or the importance of elevating those narratives of those individuals as much as the press, the Washington Post, New York Times, one may want to elevate you and make you the front man, as you noted. But at the end of the day, it's about, and people kind of lose sight of this, Rev. Rev is there, but he's a conduit.
Right.
And so exactly. how do you make that work?
The way I make it work, I started, you know, very young in the movement. I became involved. You know, I come from a single parent home, so I was always watching the news. And being in New York, I was born and raised in New York, in Brooklyn. I wanted to meet Adam Clay Pappas. I was a boy preaching. I wanted to meet a preacher that was involved. And the more I got involved, it was 67, and they were excluding Adam Clay Pappas from Congress. And there was
That's
a
right.
lot of rallies.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of rallies. And my mother got concerned because she was a fundamentalist Pentecostal woman. She brought me to the bishop and she said, he keeps talking a lot about politics and civil rights. I'm afraid he's going to leave the ministry. 12 years old. And they all wanted me to grow up and be this big preacher. And Bishop Washington, who was my pastor, said, I know what to do. He took me and her to a man called Reverend William Jones, who headed Dr. King's chapter in Brooklyn.
Right.
And he introduced me to Jesse Jackson, who at that time was twice my age. So I liked Jesse because Jesse was a little hip and then he had the big afro.
Right.
And so I literally grew up in the movement. So I was the kid nobody knew for many years. I was the one that organized the youth to march and all. Dr. King got killed that year. I was 13, became youth director. And I always said, and if I ever got in a position, I wanted to make sure that people understood it was those of us that did the work and those of us that got none of the glory that needed to be known. Right. So the way I threaded the story is the reason some people don't get involved is because they see those of us with a name and think you've got to have all these gifts and talents, but it is ordinary people that did the extraordinary thing. So I hope people read this book to know you don't have to be special to be involved. And these people, when I talk about Claudette Colvin, who was arrested 9 months before Rosa Parks in the same city, Montgomery, Alabama. And I get into some of the conflicts in our own community that we don't like to talk about. They didn't rally around Claudette because she was too dark. She's dark skinned and she was pregnant, not married. And there goes that the judgmental thing. But she inspired Rosa Parks. And Fred Gray was her lawyer, just like he was 9 months later, Rosa Parks' lawyer. People need to know that because I hope they put the book down, not to gossip about, oh, them leaders shouldn't have done that, but to say, well, I might have made mistakes in life, but I can be involved. I can make a contribution like Claudette did, or like Pauli Murray, who wrote all of the legal stuff, much of which Thurgood Marshall used for Brown versus Board of Education, but they wouldn't put her out front because she was a woman and she was gay. And what I'm trying to say to people is whatever life you live, you can make a contribution because those are the people that made the movements work.
It's an interesting backstory narrative around these individuals, these men and women whose lives, you know, very ordinary in many respects, you know, go to work, do their thing. All of this chaos around them, they find themselves in that moment in history, not knowing that history is being made, right? Someone else at some point sort of steps in front of them or is placed in front of them. And yet their story is no less important, which is the point I take away from from this book, because it really goes to the heart of if for example, Ms. Colvin had not done what she did when she did it, the way she did it, would there have been that moment for Rosa Parks? Would she have found the courage to complete that step, complete that mission? And all the politics and the personal stuff aside, how would the surrounding leadership look at that moment? You know, it is a very interesting narrative that you tell about these individuals and the very, very important, often silent role they play in shaping history.
You know, it's one of the stories I tell in there is about Mamie Mobley Till,
yes,
Till's mother. And when I met her, you know, I heard of Emmett Till. I was only 1 year old when it happened. But when I met her, and we started talking, she was a Church of God in Christ woman, just like my mother.
Yeah, my mama too. Back in the day.
And I told her, I said, you know, I grew up as a boy preaching the Church of God in Christ. She said, oh, I remember when you come to Chicago, a little boy preaching. And she said, I'm saved, sanctified, filled with the Holy Ghost. And this woman, whose son was killed in Mississippi, and I write the whole story, she changed history. Because she decided when she brought Emmett's body back to Chicago for the funeral, she was going to open the casket and show the brutalized body of her son. Connect the dots. Rosa Parks said when she sat on that bus and they told her that she could not sit there to move to the back and she would move, she said, all I could think about was Emmett Till. If Mamie had not opened that casket, she would not have thought about Emmett Till.
Right.
And everybody remembers Emmett Till. Everybody remembers Rosa Parks. But nobody remembered Mamie. And if Mamie hadn't done that one thing or opened that casket, I don't know that the Emmett Till story would have ever been told like it was.
How do we, you know, through books like yours, obviously, and just for folks, you know, just to keep you in the loop, Righteous Troublemakers by Reverend Al Sharpton is out now. How do we, those of us who don't have the time or fortune, not meaning money, but the ability and the support to put a book out like this, how do we as just everyday citizens tell that story? From your experience in your service to the community, your engagement with institutions that you've challenged, you bring people in the room. And just for full disclosure, I have to tell folks, when I ran for the U.S. Senate, Al Sharpton, you know, was, you know, we battled on the policy, but we stayed connected in the community, if folks know what I mean. It wasn't because it was about, okay, here's this brother doing some stuff, I don't agree with him, but let's see if we get him in the room and see what he has to say.
Right.
And so you've always afforded people that opportunity. How do we now take that lesson? Because in this environment we have right now, there's a lot of good people out there trying to do good things to save this democracy, Al. And I get the question all the time, I'm sure you do too, what can I do? I feel helpless in this process. And what we try to tell them is, you're not alone. Look at the neighbor to your right and your left and engage with them on these issues. How do you see that narrative playing out?
You hit it right there. You've got to start in your neighborhood, just your neighbors, your family. Talk about these things, get a small group together. I started National Action Network 30 years ago. I had four people. When we had to sign the incorporation papers, we had to get five people. One of them that signed the incorporation papers, show you how starting small is, was a cop. That cop is now the mayor of New York, Eric Adams.
I love it.
National Action Network. So if you start with a small circle and clear about we want to do, you don't want to change maybe the Supreme Court law. You want to deal with the street corner block.
Right.
Or the light on the block. You want to deal with garbage pickup. You want to deal with the cop that's mean. And you build from there. And you are open to people that want to talk, even if you debate. One of the reasons you and I always got along and we had so much respect for you is I would tell my circle, I said, you want me to tell you something? In 68, when I got involved, when I became youth director, Dr. King was killed. I worked for a woman running for Congress named Shirley Chisholm. I was a youth volunteer, mm-hmm. became a youth coordinator. She ran against a guy who Nixon had sent to Brooklyn to run named James Farmer, one of the icons in the civil rights movement. He was a Republican. He was a decent man. Yeah. Just because he was Republican didn't mean he didn't agree. He paid dues for us. They said, really? The guy that started affirmative action was a Republican named Art Fletcher.
I knew Art Fletcher.
I said, we can't let all of these that we may disagree on one or two points not understand we are all looking at the same thing. We may just approach it different ways. And everybody's got something to say. So if you start small, argue with your cousin, argue with your nieces and nephews, but let's do something.
Yeah, I think that's an important point because it is about what we can do. And I want to get into that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more with Reverend Al and his new book, Righteous Troublemakers, because we all can be a little bit righteous in our troublemaking every once in a while, right after this.
I'm Dr. Andrew Jacobs, host of the Sports Psychology Hour. Is your New Year's resolution to become stronger, healthier, and more resilient? Then start with the Rewire Fitness Neuro Performance app. Rewire Fitness takes a holistic approach to achieving peak performance, letting you strengthen both your body and mind with Rewire's integrated resilience training system. Go to winnersunlimited.com/rewire. Click Learn More to sign up for your free 7-day trial of Rewire Fitness. That's winnersunlimited.com/rewire.
Welcome back, everyone. We're having a great conversation with the Reverend Al Sharpton, founder and CEO of National Action Network and all around good guy, colleague of mine at MSNBC, and the author of the new book, Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. It talks about the men and women out there who do the everyday lift of fighting for justice, reminding us of what justice means in this country. And the Reverend has put this book in sharp relief by telling the stories of men and women that many of whom you may not be familiar with. And so I highly recommend you pick up a copy and get a little history lesson, but also get a better appreciation, understanding of what your neighbor has done over the past few years of moving the agenda. You talk, Reverend, in the book at one point, and you made reference earlier to the older gentleman that had come down and, you know, who wanted to show you his button and say, I was here before. You then go on and you talk about, and I thought this was a very interesting juxtaposition of the moment. It didn't go unnoticed by me and others that only a few hours earlier and just 1 mile away, President Donald Trump has stood on the South Lawn of the White House to condemn us. In his mind, we were agitators bent on destroying the American way of life. I don't give too much about Donald Trump talking about the condemnation of anybody because Donald Trump condemning someone is not worth the time to discuss. But what I thought was important about what you said, and you put it in quotations, was the American way of life. What is that for Black folks versus what it is for white folks?
Black folks come into American life at birth with a socioeconomic disadvantage. When you're born and your race is on your birth certificate, they can almost say what kind of zip code you're going to live in, mm-hmm. quality of education in that zip code, the employment opportunities, which is qualitatively different than whites. That some whites don't even understand that. So you are doubly unemployed, even in a good economy. With unemployment rate is a little under 4% now. It's over 7% for blacks in a good account. When you deal with the quality of education, when you deal with the quality of healthcare. So this is systemic, and it makes them feel that we are other than, but they do not understand it is not based on our acumen or our intellect. It's based on a system that first saw us as chattel and then as commodities and all the way to we fighting for the full realization of being full citizens and regarded as full human beings. That's what the struggle has always been about. And I think that a lot of us do not understand that these things are what we are facing and have faced throughout American history. So when you get a guy like Mitch McConnell that slips and says, well, African-Americans vote like other Americans, it's their subconsciously don't see us as Americans, because Americans are supposed to be upwardly mobile and landowners and profitable and all that. And they don't see us in that stereotype, though many of us are.
Right.
But it is because much of us have been systematically excluded from that, that we become something other than, rather than people realize that is the designation we're given. That's what the struggle has always been about.
It's true on so many levels, because you find yourselves, I mean, I just, when you were talking, just thinking back to some of the experiences that I've had, you know, presumably on the other side of the civil rights movement, you know, the marching had been done, the voting and civil rights have been passed, and everybody was singing Kumbaya, yet I'm sitting in Georgetown Law School, and I've got this white boy who looks at me and said, well, how did you get here?
Wow.
I'm like, oh, okay, we're going to do that. All right, let's do that. Okay, we're going to do that. And, you know, we got into it because he goes on and says, well, yeah, I had a buddy of mine who applied to Georgetown and didn't get in. I went, well, I guess he just wasn't as smart as I am.
Wow.
And the reality of it was, we are always having to prove ourselves from the moment of birth to death. And what is so compelling about that scene that you had with the older gentleman on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial 58 years later is you think about his life, you think about your life, and you think about the lives of the young people in front of you. And the sad part of the narrative is there are a lot of aspects of it that haven't changed. You're still having to prove yourself. You know, Reverend Al is still having to stand up in front of white corporate America and say, y'all just need to sit your butts down now because y'all got this wrong. Let me tell you what you need to do.
Right.
You know, young people today are still having to confront, as much as we are much more symbiotic in our relationships and across cultural and embracing all these various communities, you still see, you know, young white boys in khakis and tiki torches. Protesting the civil rights of their fellow Americans. You note in I think it's around page 135 or so in the book, where you say, one of the reasons I'm still an activist, why I still link arms and march, is because I don't want anyone to accept being treated like a slave, someone less than. I protest that very ideology. You have to be out front have to be out front and raising your voice for someone else to understand that they too don't have to accept that kind of thinking. So when you look at the older gentleman, yourself, and the young people that day, you begin to appreciate that sentence. You know, why you still do what you have to do, because you're constantly trying to change the thinking, trying to get people to see you first as a human being as opposed to a Black man, and that's all right. The stereotypes that come with that. So you're gonna stay in the fight till that work is done.
That's my life commitment. I remember when Michael Brown was killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, and we went in, the family asked us to come in, National Action Network. And I remember we were at a rally one night at his church, and his mother said something that really got to me. She said, Mark Twain said something. And I'm like, Leslie's gonna quote Mark Twain? And she said, Mark Twain said, the two most important moments in your life is the moment you're born and the moment you find out why you were born. And she said, I found out that I was born to fight for mothers like what happened with my son. Yeah. And I sat there and said, that's why I can't stop. I feel that that's what I'm born to do, to say to people that we must affirm our humanity. So people thought when I was younger and was out there marching and carrying on, he's trying to make a name. Well, I have a TV show now, a radio show now. I got an organization all over the country. I have access to the White House. Why am I doing it now? Because those are just platforms to give the public on why I do what I do. I still do the same thing, whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's George Floyd, or whether it was 30 years ago in Howard Beach. And the other thing that is important, Michael, that people don't understand is that even if you don't win every case, I was glad we won the Aubrey case with George. I was glad we got convictions with George Floyd. Even if you don't win every case, young Black kids like me that grow up in single parent home on welfare, they realize they're of value when they see people stand up for them. Because I can't tell you the amount of young people said, you know, at least somebody cares. Imagine if there was no protest and something happened to a George Floyd. The message, the subliminal message you send to everybody is we don't matter.
We don't matter. It's okay.
And we don't even matter to ourselves. Yeah. So that's why I go, because I can't tell you in the last 15 years when I've become more known and respected, is that the reaction I get most places when I go to a Brunswick, Georgia, or even Minneapolis, I didn't think you would come. Because they have been subconsciously feeling that, well, we ain't all that. Yes, we are. All of us are. And we've got to affirm that.
And the response by some, and including some on my side of the aisle in the Republican Party, is that when you show up, they don't focus on the why you're there. The young individual who's been shot and killed by the police, or some other horrific moment, they focus on the personality of the man.
Exactly.
So they try to make you the caricature, the bad guy in the scenario, and sublimate the truth of why you're there. How have you dealt with that part of this? Where you
I've tried
take yourself out of the narrative.
I've tried to break it down to put the families out and the narrative out. But then at the same time, tell the families that let me take the flak. See, because no family, and I write in there about George Floyd families and other families, Philonis and all, and I stay close to these families down through the years. The one thing my staff, we have officers all over the country, and they always laugh, is that Reverend Al will not let us get between him and the families. I call the mothers on Mother's Day and Christmas. I'm talking about cases I fought 25 years ago, because you end up kind of drawing that kind of relationship.
Sure.
And what I try to do is deflate the attacks on them, because they don't volunteer to be activists.
Right.
So if they didn't beat up on me, they go dig up.
And they're dealing with the pain of a loss of a loved one or something, you know.
The trauma of it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to protect that. But at the same time, I said to a guy, that I won't call his name, the host of the show at Fox News, who does these caricatures of me, I said, let me ask you something. I said, there's nothing more sacred particularly in the black church, than funeral. He said, yeah. He says, I think that's true in our church. I said, well, have you ever noticed that I never broke into a funeral? The family asked me to come and deliver the eulogy. That's a very serious thing. He said, I never thought about that. I said, what you need to do is ask yourself, why do they ask for me? Because then you'd have to deal with the cause they want raised rather than the character that raised it.
That's right. That's right.
It wasn't like I was their pastor. But mm-hmm. they wanted that statement made. It just happened to be Al Sharpton. It could be anybody.
Right.
As long as that statement is made. These people weren't members of National Action Network or the NAACP, but these people wanted that statement made. And rather than deal with the cause, you want to deal with those that make you have to hear the call.
Well, and that makes it easier to deflect because they don't want to have to deal, like you said, with that underlying reality. And more importantly, their response to it.
Exactly.
There's nothing worse than a mirror being held up to you.
That's right. And give you an example. You mentioned earlier about Donald Trump's attacks on Al March and on me, and he's attacked you and everybody else. And people have said, New York Times did a story on the front page about how we were frenemies because I used to deal with him and fight with him in New York, but he'd always invite me to his functions and the boxing matches and all.
Right.
And I said to a guy, I said, let me ask you something. I was coming to Baltimore. I remember this attack. And you were going to be there. We were doing something
That's
with
right.
some of the businessmen.
That's right.
And that morning, he had tweeted something against me. I was a con man. I was this, that, and other. Well, who was I when you were sitting at ringside in boxing match? So, I mean, in one minute, you say Al and I were friends. Well, why were we friends? I'm the same Al Sharpton. I've been that for 30, 40 years.
Right.
So it is clear that if you try and give us these caricatures for political reasons, you don't even believe that yourself.
So let me ask you, so Rev, in writing this book, you had to, and there are moments where it comes across almost as reflection of where rallies and protests and movements, activism how it has evolved. I've actually said on our air at MSNBC, one of the things that I find so shocking is how easily people move off of that is not the first inclination during the Trump administration, during the transitional period where he was trying to undermine the election, and we're seeing more and more of that revelation come out now, that people didn't take to the streets. They didn't declare the sanctity of the vote and actually want to do something about it. So in one sense, National Action Network, your efforts with these families is almost an outlier. It's not, because back in the day, I mean, there were marches planned Mississippi, Alabama, Washington, New York. I mean, it was
simultaneous.
I mean, it was just one of those things. I mean, the closest we saw to that was, I guess it was the Universal Day where everyone kind of globally focused on George Floyd's killing.
Right.
But closer to home on matters like voting and voting rights, the John Lewis legislation, where do you think that activism is? How is it manifesting itself?
I think that a lot of us got into other things and too comfortable. And I think it's beginning to wind back now because in many ways, I think the election of Barack Obama made a lot of us feel we don't have to do that no more.
That's true.
And
I heard it. I know you heard it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me tell you, I heard it. It's ironic when you and I have this conversation, it's in the week of the 10th anniversary of Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
And when Trayvon happened, and I went down to Florida at his mother's and Ben Crump, the lawyer's request, and start having marches. People say, oh, no, we got a black president. What are you doing, Reverend Al? I said, I meet with the black president. But do you think they're going to do anything if we don't keep this out there?
Right.
Marching doesn't solve a problem. Rallying doesn't solve it. It exposes a problem.
That's right.
But no one is going to do anything about it unless you keep the public eye. If you remember Trayvon, they had decided never to even prosecute Zimmerman. They were not going to arrest him. Stand your ground, he was in, right? It was the marchers that forced the prosecutor to say, we're going to indict him. Now, we didn't win the case, but they never intended for him to go to court. And I think a lot of it is that people are now slowly understanding you're going to need that kind of mobilization, because if you don't and you relax too much, a Donald Trump's going to happen. Because the fact of the matter is, in American history, the man that got the most votes for president of the United States was Joe Biden. More votes than Barack Obama, Don Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson. But the second man was Donald Trump. That element has not gone anywhere. Right. And if you don't keep a limelight on that element, if we had not had that global marches around George Floyd and kept it going with that videotape, people would have forgot it. George Floyd's not the only one that got killed. It was the rallying. Rallying is to keep something in the public mind. You know better than anyone, public officials have to react to what the public is thinking about. If you take it off the table, they're not going to bring it up voluntarily.
So we have the opportunity coming up to see the president of the United States, Joe Biden, nominate to the Supreme Court a potential righteous troublemaker. The black women being considered right now have stellar legal and judicial backgrounds. And yet we see already, to your last point, folks trying to take away from that, to characterize it in a way that reflects, I think, more on them, to be honest, than on these women that are being considered, that, you know, particularly Republicans. And I had to tweet at Susan Collins because of her interview this past weekend on with George Stephanopoulos, when she could not say with clarity, I'm just going to support whoever he nominates, because now he's politicized it by, you know, selecting a black woman. Well, he didn't know. Did Reagan politicize it when he said he was going to name a white woman to the court? Or did Donald Trump politicize it when he not only said he gave you a list of white men, he put a full list, 2 pages of white men he was going to put on the Supreme Court. How do we look at these potential righteous troublemakers today and support them and uplift them in a way that, quite honestly, protects them in their leadership and their opportunity? Because it just feels somewhat different. In some cases, a lot of these folks tend to be alone by themselves. And they've got a Reverend Al in their corner, but Reverend Al can't be everywhere. And so how do you see that?
We've got to people around the country ought to be saying to their 2 senators, their email, phone call, whatever, that the issue is not that Joe Biden committed to put a black woman on the Supreme Court. The issue is why there's never been a black woman on the Supreme Court. And what are you saying, that black women throughout the almost 300-year history of the country, there's no black woman that was qualified to be on the Supreme Court? I want you as my senator to vote for whoever he nominates as long as they're qualified. The issue is why it took this long. And I think that is what everybody can do. I tell people on my radio show every day, right, whatever city, state you're in, everyone has 2 U.S. senators. Write an email to your senator or call your senator and leave a message in the office. You know, as one that has held elected office, if you come in your office and your staff say, we got 70 calls saying so, that gets your attention.
Oh, it gets your attention. Oh, yeah. Oh, in a heartbeat. And the thing to keep in mind, folks, in these Senate and congressional offices, but in the case of the Supreme Court, Senate offices, if they get 10 phone calls on an issue, they don't get 70 or 80, they get 10 or 15. Oh, it stirs the pot that day in that office. And you know, everybody's like, okay, what's going on? What do we have to do? So, Rev, before I let you get out of here, this is a two-part question for you. And the first one is based on your, even though you were young at the time, but still exposed to Dr. King in a way that a lot of us were not. How do you think Dr. King would see America today after 60 plus years of struggle to achieve what, you know, he laid out very simply on that August 28th, 1963? How do you think he would see us today?
You know, I think from knowing his widow well and working hand in hand with his son, I only saw Dr. King a couple of times, but I learned a lot about him from them. Nobody knew him better than Coretta Scott King, who was his partner and his wife. I think he would be saddened that we still are facing the same issue, but determined, because I think he understood that this is not gonna happen overnight, that the struggle is continuing. And when I've met and had long conversations with people like Nelson Mandela, they understand. I never get Mandela said, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And you got to run your lap. And you got to be at peace with it didn't begin with you and it won't end with you. Right. But you got to try to move the baton as much closer to the finish line as you can. You may never get there. And if we see Martin Luther King's last speech, he said in there, I've been to the mountaintop, I've seen the promised land. Right. I may not get there with you. I think he resolved that he would never see it all. And we're not going to see it all. But our job is to move it closer. And it is closer. Because in Dr. King's day, Barack Obama was never even imagined.
Right.
60 blacks in Congress wasn't imagined. Black mayors all over wasn't imagined. Lieutenant Governor Maryland wasn't imagined. Right. So sometimes in the pursuit of what we're doing, we don't realize we have made some mileage. We've got to protect it, because there are always those that when you go one step forward, want to push you two steps back.
And the final question is a little bit more introspective, I guess, for you personally. How, for the people who read the book, Righteous Troublemakers, what do you want them, not just to take away from it, but how do you see a modern day righteous troublemaker?
One that goes out and does what they can for the community, for the beloved community, King would say, the broader community, and doesn't do it for any other reason than the righteousness of his call. And I'm doing it because it's right. And if you do what is right, you'll get some kind of reward, maybe a recognition, it may be something else. But that everybody needs to ask themselves the question that Leslie raised from Mark Twain: what is my life about? Mm-hmm. You know, I often preach funerals, and I always tell people that I am very reluctant to preach a funeral of somebody that I've got to make up stuff to say why we're here mourning them. All of us at one day will have a funeral. And what was the meaning of my life? Right. So what you do is not just for others, it's to define who you are and become a righteous troublemaker.
And he has been a righteous troublemaker, folks, since he was about 13 years old. So from the shadows to the front of the stage, but always present, the Reverend Al Sharpton. The book is The Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. He is a buddy, a colleague, and I'm proud of the work you do out there, Rev. We may disagree on the policy, but maybe the goal is always the same: to improve the quality of life of the people in our community and this country, and adhere to the tenets that we espouse. And you've been one of those soldiers on that forefront for a long time, and we appreciate you.
Well, likewise, I've always been proud that I know Michael Steele and proud of what you do. We don't have to agree in the fine print, but the goals are the same.
Absolutely, my friend. Folks, check out Righteous Troublemakers from the Reverend Al Sharpton. You'll find it at all the fine places you get your books, Amazon, etc. Don't forget to do that wonderful thing that makes me feel all yummy inside. Download the podcast for sure. Check me out on Twitter at Michael Steele. You can check out the Reverend Al Sharpton on Twitter. Reverend, you are, what's your Twitter again?
It's at Reverend Al.
At the Rev Al. That's right. At the Rev Al. And follow him on Twitter. And don't forget to get a copy of Righteous Troublemakers. Until next time, folks, be safe, be well, take care, get the vaccine. All right, come on, stop being stupid. You know, wear the mask. You know, your mama appreciates you more when you behave. So you guys take care until next time.
America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
I'm Dr. Andrew Jacobs. As a sports psychologist, with 38 years of experience, I've worked with athletes, coaches, parents, and officials, assisting them at learning how to handle issues like sportsmanship, self-confidence, developing a positive, realistic attitude, and achieving maximum performance. I want more people to know about the importance of having fun, learning from failure, and that winning is about doing your best. That's why I created the Sportsmanship Foundation, a 501c3 educational organization dedicated to promoting and educating parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Our priority is to help bring back the fun into youth sports.
If you're interested in learning more or making a donation, go to winnersunlimited.com/radio. That's winnersunlimited.com/radio. Doing your best, having fun, and becoming a winner. The Sportsmanship Foundation at winnersunlimited.com/radio.